Without the ones like you, who work tirelessly to keep things running, everything would suddenly stop. Hospitals, factories, schools, and power plants, they all depend on you. No matter the weather, emergency, or time of day, you're the ones who get it done. At Grainger, we're here for you, with professional-grade industrial supplies. Count on real-time product availability and fast delivery. Call, clickgrainger.com or just stop by. Grainger, for the ones who get it done.
Yo, 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 welcome to Pulse to the Wall. Tonight we are joined by Andrew from Popular Liberty and Tyler and soon Mike after, you know, he wrestles his kids to bed. So, Andrew, how are you doing tonight?
I'm good, guys. How are you guys? How are the Pauls doing?
They're solid. Tyler isn't, he's a Paul in spirit, by the way. But
oh, okay.
We'll count so him one. He's an honorary Paul.
Yeah.
Oops.
But I'm doing well. Doing well.
Yeah. Right. So Andrew, a lot of our listeners are probably familiar with you. You know, we're very much in the same circles. So for the listeners that are not, can you explain kind of what your background is and how you've kind of risen as a YouTuber slash, you know, libertarian thinker?
Well, my background is basically I'm the inventor of the archotropism framework. That's the what I consider to be the missing piece to libertarianism. And it deals with basically the economics and the movements of the value of power. How power behaves. It's all the incentive systems of, you know, how a political power, how coercive power, you know, behaves itself. And, you know, for 50 years, libertarians have, you know, done everything they can not to have this conversation with themselves. And, you know, and now it's kind of gotten to a head where, you know, most of us got put on house arrest for, you know, most of last year. So it's like, all right, time to have the conversation now. We need to talk about power and why it exists.
Yeah. So if anybody hasn't heard your work on archotropism, tonight we're going to do something a little bit different. You talked about it on Lines of Liberty, on Pete Quinones' podcast. I know a couple others. I know you talked about it with Adam Patrick on not Run Your Mouth. That's Robbie Bernstein.
You're talking over me.
Yeah, you're right. Kind of similar. But yeah, so if anybody wants to hear the sort of like philosophy broken down, check out all of those shows and, you know, the Popular Liberty episodes they did. Mm-hmm. So tonight we're going to talk about how those ideas translate into the real world, like the praxis of archotropism and what we've seen really the last year and a half with like the sort of acceleration of government power and force. So the one idea that really stuck out to me that was like a light bulb when I heard it was when you talked about this kind of Misesian idea of time preference and how something like the Constitution is like a low time preference for power framework. And it clicked with me immediately because I've heard that idea talked about sort of tangentially. I know like Murray Rothbard talked about, you know, how the smallest government would create the most powerful economy. And then once there's a powerful economy, the state parasitically drafts off of that and becomes powerful. So This kind of runs very parallel to that idea. Now, what would you say differentiates it from that sort of idea? Like, you know, when it comes to the Constitution, creating this eventual power cell, how would you differentiate that from something like, you know, I think it was Rothbard that originally came up with that. But what is like the ingredient there that you think was missing?
The ingredient there, I think that is missing is something that libertarians have said for a while, because they've had this, they never quite connected what he said right there with what Spooner had said about, okay, either the Constitution failed to stop this or it, or it was, you know, responsible for causing it. And actually he had those in reverse order, but it was they never made that connection there that yes, it is the Constitution that, you know, artificially lowered the state's time preference for power. And you see this throughout the 19th century where, you know, the total taxes. So if you add up local, state, federal and beyond, it never really got above 10%. And today it's like closer to 45%.
Yeah. Know, so,
and as a percent of the whole economy. And so the basically, you know, what it just artificially lowered it to where they were just taking less and less and less and leaving more for the rest of us, which created this incredibly powerful economy that gave us the monstrosity we have today. So,
right.
It forced under consumption.
Right, right. So if I think of like the logical extremes of this, it brings me back to, did you ever read Peter Schiff's How an Economy Grows and Why It Crashes?
No, I did not, but I do like Peter Schiff, and I've listened to him for a long time.
It was very much his sort of like teenagers could read it. Like, he uses the example of people living on an island, and it's like, every day to sustain themselves, they can catch one fish with their bare hands, and that's their subsistence living. But as soon as they invent nets, then they have time to build shelter and fire and everything. And to me, it's like, when you're talking about this idea, it's like, okay, what's the logical extreme of very high time preference behavior? It's like, okay, if there's a downed plane on an island, and there's one guy that's going to declare himself the dictator over the people on this island, it's like, how powerful is he really going to get when it's just a bunch of people living in abject poverty? He's going to be a joke. You can't have that much power. Yeah, exactly. So it's like, on the other end of that spectrum, we have something like early America, our first two centuries, where we had this very free market economy relatively. And we had all of this wealth creation, especially in the 19th century. And then slowly but surely, like, the world wars come along and the power starts to grow and grow and grow with this newfound wealth. So like, when you brought that idea up, it like immediately started connecting all these dots in my mind. And I think this is like truly an original contribution.
Oh, yeah. I mean, again, this is something the time preference itself, that is something that people have had Misesians had talked about for a very long time, but connecting it to power, I think that's something that hadn't quite been done yet. And they'd seen the results of it, but they never quite described it that way. Hans Hoppe was the first to really do that with his Democracy of the God That Failed, and he connected time preference for power to monarchy and to democracy, and showing that monarchy is a much lower time preference form of government, because you're the guy in charge. No one can take that from you. And, you want to hand that, the kingdom down like it's a family business to your kid. And so you have an incentive not to like screw the pooch, don't take the goose that laid the golden egg and slit its throat. And whereas if you're in democracy, you get rewarded by deliberately dividing people and pitting them against each other. So, it takes 50% plus one to gain power and be able to deal out all the favors to all your political cronies. And so, you immediately get the majority against the minority. And, and you can do that by, making false promises, by promising to rob the minority in favor of the majority. And so you end up squandering the wealth of society pretty quickly, and you're just incentivized to do it. And I don't know how much we should really blame our politicians for doing what they're incentivized to do. I mean, we're literally willing to pay them to divide us and rob us. That's democracy. And
yeah, I think that at the end of the day, they're humans like the rest of us. And it's very easy for a lot of people on the outside looking in, and I'm not defending them, but you put any one of us, hardcore libertarians, ANCAPs, whatever you want to call, in that same situation, and tell me that once those dollars start flowing, you're not going to be like, maybe we should add some pork to this bill. Let's add some.
Yeah, I mean, maybe you find a way for it. Maybe at first you think, maybe I could use this for some good things. Maybe help fund the Mises Institute a little more and reward my allies in the Mises Caucus who helped get me elected. I'm sure that most of them are entrepreneurs with their own businesses that, if their businesses succeeded a little more, maybe they would donate a little more, and that helps the whole cause, and you can just rationalize it to yourself that way, and it goes right along. And it's just the way, humans, we're not like moral creatures. We're still animals, and we respond to incentives as animals. I mean, we're just a bunch of bald primates. That's what this is. And if you create a system to reward people for doing bad things, don't be surprised when they do it. And if you want unity, you're in the wrong government. A lot of people, they hate politics because of the division of it. And it's like, this is democracy. That's what that is. It's divide and conquer. By this is the definition of the win conditions.
You need an enemy at all times.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, look at, they turned a virus into an enemy.
Pretty much.
They literally turned a virus.
Who divide us and conquer us and rape us for $10 trillion last year. So. Yes.
Yeah, so this is kind of like a bigger picture question that I thought would be fun to get into. Like this process that we're talking about of you have a constitutional republic that eventually ends in tyranny and sort of consolidation of power. How much of this is just an unpreventable, like, natural ending to things? Like, it's kind of our destiny. It's like the fourth turning idea.
All of it. The problem with, the central problem is like that first law that I talk about is that, but the kind of the implication of that, the first law is that the, one second, let me get the exact definition right here. The value of power is relative, not absolute. Therefore, the value of power can neither be created nor destroyed. It may be only transferred from one wielder to another or transformed from one form into another. The sum total value of power is always conserved. Because of that, basically implied right there is that power, coercive power, has value. And when you understand, like, the, what Rothbard wrote about in, Man, Economy, and State, I believe. I might be wrong about that, but I'm pretty sure that was where it was, Man, Economy, and State. He said, he talked about the law of returns, is that, humans are economizers. We want to have the most bang for our buck, basically. We want to get the most most ends out of the least amount of means. And so when you have some, howdy, Mike.
Hey, how you doing, Andrew?
Good. Nice to finally meet you.
You too. Yeah, mm-hmm. Sorry, I had to wrestle the kids to bed. This is becoming kind of regular now for me at this time. So, anyhow, onward.
We were just discussing why states are effectively inevitable. Mm-hmm. And so if you understand that, coercive power has value and that humans are economizers and we're going to try to get the maximum value out of something, I mean, the first thing we're going to do is create hierarchy to, naturally extract more of that value and try to make it that process more efficient. This is what we do with all corporations and all kinds of businesses. And, it's this hierarchy, behavior that humans have is, allows us to collectivize and gather our talents together and coordinate with each other effectively, with the decision-making effectively outsourced to one person or another. And this is what makes, economic processes more efficient. So, if we're trying to maximize and get the most bang for our buck, this coercive aggression thing is valuable and we want to maximize value. Well, then we're going to create a hierarchy for extracting a value from aggression. That's a state. And, you have two things, hierarchy and aggression, which are both inevitable because they both have value. And so when you have this overturning of, democracy into monarchy and then back again, this is just the consolidation of power that is incentivized. And there's not, this is a major hurdle for anarchy is, what do you do about the value of power? There's not a good solution to it.
So what do you think, again, going to this kind of natural process and revolution, what do you think the next step is from here? Like, what should the movement of the Liberty Movement, what should the goal be right now in 2021, looking at this, like, full steam ahead towards the iceberg that we're facing right now? And what happens if we are successful in whatever this goal is? And what happens if we are not?
Ooh, well, okay, but, there isn't much you can do about the overturning of history because, what always happens is, okay, so when you have oligarchy, the reason, that you should think of that as unconsolidated power, that's chaos. And so you have this archotropism framework that kind of tells you that right off the bat that order is preferable to chaos. And if you have people by nature, they don't like chaos and they demand order. And so, and they place an extra value on whoever gives that order. And if you can say, okay, well, we like a defensive order first, and the best defense is a good offense. So in a roundabout way, you wind up with an aggressive order is what people demand because it's the most effective. And this state is here to provide an aggressive order. And when you have divided power like what we have now in oligarchy, you get just a shit show. It's all chaos. And this is something I was talking about last night on my on my show, you know, with reading the Art of War by Sun Tzu, as he goes into he went in on chapter 10 and 11, talked about you know, hey, if the general you know, can't consolidate power, if he's, you know, chaotic, if his orders are unclear, and defeat is inevitable, and people don't like that. You know, it's disorder to them. So, you know, naturally, power will, you know, try to converge itself into, you know, a centralized authority, because that's what's most efficient. And it always, and so what, and but eventually, you know, that if you try to hand that power down to someone who's weak and can't hold on to the power, he's not strong enough to maintain it, you break back apart into oligarchy, and the cycle repeats. So right now we're at the end stage of oligarchy, and we're headed towards basically dictatorship. This is why all republics end in dictatorship. Every single time.
I was gonna agree with you there. I've been telling anyone that'll listen to me, I said, you keep the way that the things keep pushing along, and I always use the progressive movement as an example of this. I said they're gonna push so far left that the right is going to give a reactionary movement, and it's going to be exactly what you just described. The strong man delivering order, values, you know, we're going to bring everything back, and they're going to get a dictator, and they're going to, it's going to make, you know, supposedly people called Trump a fascist. This, the next person in line will make Trump look a screaming child on a playground.
Yeah. I think Trump was sort of like the trial run of that. It's like, hey, here's this idea. But I mean, really, we know that he bent the knee to the establishment. He didn't really do anything of substance.
Yeah. I mean, he was the spitting image of what they were supposed to fear, of what they knew was supposed to be coming, given, you know, the way history has always played out. I mean, when it was Rome's turn, you know, they had Julius Caesar come along, and he was a populist. He was a right winger who came from the outside. You know, he was a general, not a senator. And, you know, he had his own wealth, basically the army, and it was basically the billionaire of the day. He came from a rich family, and, you know, he was a real, you know, right winger who, you know, when he first came in, he first was like, oh, we're all going to be working together and getting along. And the Senate's like, no, he's a dictator and he's going to come after us and we need to go to war with him. And, you know, then they, you know, so Pompey and the rest of the Senate, you know, fled Rome, gathered an army to come after Julius Caesar. He ends up beating them, even though he was outnumbered, like, you know, 4-1 or something like that. And, you know, and in a shock upset, then he gets back and he's like, he pardons everyone. He's like, okay, no worries. You know, he didn't go out. And then they end up, you know, betraying him and killing him. And, you know, he got betrayed and killed by his own party and all of his friends. And, you know, it's like same thing happened with Trump. He was basically the American Julius Caesar, you know, right wing populist. Again, Julius Caesar, he's in the party Populares for populist, and he was opposed to the Optimates party for, you know, basically the elites and the progressives. You know, the modern equivalent is history's all playing itself out over and over again. And if you look at, you know, who ended up beating him, granted this was slightly different in Rome's story where, you know, he ended up fucking Cleopatra and that's how she got into the halls of power. You have Kamala Harris here who fucked her way into the halls of power.
Well, I was going to ask if Melania Trump was the equivalent of Cleopatra in this instance.
Nope, but, you know,
well, I guess the progressives didn't try to murder their kid, so.
Yeah, but the, basically, I mean, you got the whole story playing itself out again, and, you know, they knew that they had gone really far left and there's going to be a demand for a right winger from the right. And then here's Trump. He fits the bill. And so they start freaking the fuck out and he's not the guy. And unfortunately, he's the Julius Caesar that's going to give us the guy, you know, who now knows that he's going to basically the next guy now has a ready-made excuse to, you know, campaign against the bureaucracy. And say that, look at what they did to, you know, our guy, Trump, you know, and we need some vengeance. And my mandate is to go to war with this bureaucracy and to get, you know, pay them back for what they did. And we're going to get rid of this system that caused so much hardship to all of us. My mandate is to burn the system to the ground. And if you elect me, this is what I'm here to do. And then they just gave whoever this next guy Augustus is, whoever the American Augustus is, they just handed him the excuse that he needed to do all of that. So, and that's like your own fear did them in, you know, basically they did it to themselves. It's like, you remember this idea that, you know, you create the thing you fear. They just did that to themselves. That's archotropism. You know, they have this chaos. It demands an order to consolidate it. It's their chaos and their disorder that now is demanding this right-wing demagogue to come back and take everything from them. And they did it to themselves.
You know what this is making me think of? I'm going to hit you guys with some bro science here. But you know how they say that basically a lot of natural fears that people have are like genetic memories? Like, there's a good reason that people are like instinctively afraid of snakes or the dark, because that's where the monsters are. That's how you get hurt. And like, I like how you use this kind of long view of history, especially because 21st century Americans have goldfish memories. They don't even remember what the CDC said 3 months ago.
Does the CDC remember?
Yeah. You know, and then it's like, okay, well, you can go back 2000 years and look at the Roman Empire and you can learn a lot from, you know, things that happened long, long, long ago, because like you said, these patterns do repeat themselves. And I think like when you're talking about Trump, it's almost like there was this genetic memory that, oh no, we're supposed to be afraid of this. This is how we don't get our way.
Well, I what I think it is
it clicked when you mentioned that. And, you know, like looking at this long view of history, looking outside of kind of modern democracies, if you had to look at one leader who wielded power sort of correctly, to put it that way, who would you say that guy is, like from any time period in time?
Fuck, they all suck.
Yeah, they do. That's why it's
gosh, that's a tough question.
But yeah, if we're gonna interested in this topic at all,
like, I would say that, relative. I mean, I would give two, one relatively recent, who, you know, a guy who at least he understood it. And, you know, it's like he understood the moment, he understood what was happening, and he reacted accordingly. You know, that would be, you know, Augusto Pinochet. It's like he saw what was happening, he knew this was bad, and he acted accordingly. I mean, it was barbaric how he went about it. And, you know, I mean, helicopter memes are kind of funny, and but, you know, if you're actually dropping a communist out of a helicopter, okay, it's like, I get it. I mean, he defended his country against basically foreign invade, you know, effectively, you know, internal foreign invaders who were going to kill a lot of people. And it's like, he did the right thing. He wielded power the right way, but gosh, history was not kind to him. And you know, but and he was not kind to a whole, and there were a lot, whole lot of innocent people that he definitely, you know, threw out of the helicopters with the communists. And well, and so, but you know, even going back to Rome, Augustus, you know, he played his cards excellently, and he was he consolidated all of the greatest empire up until that point into the empire it became.
And, well, you know, you're talking about like how history looks back on Pinochet unfavorably, and understandably so. Those are brutal tactics, but we don't have a time machine or a crystal ball to see how things would have played out if he were not successful in doing what he did. And it's like, okay, well, we can play the counterfactual the other way, where it's like, what if in Moscow in, you know, the early 20th century, what if they were able to thwart the Bolsheviks using like brutal tactics? Would we look back and say, like, guys, that was indefensible, you're evil for doing this? And it's like, they could have saved 100 million lives. Who knows? Yeah. You know? So it's really hard to play that game. Well, where I think we're all trained to say bad man, bad man.
In the Russian Revolution, they were faced with an impossible choice because both options sucked.
Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, yeah, remember on our very first episode, we had Matt Erickson on, and this is the day after the election, right when everything went sideways. We thought went to bed thinking he won, and then woke up, and it's like, whoa, what's going on? We recorded that, I think, the day or the day after. But he said something to the effect, and I don't think it was his original quote, he or somebody else say it, that, like, Trump was us asking nicely, and that the next guy is the one that's going to, like, become the one that they wanted Trump to be, like you were just saying. So
that's the incentive. Yeah. And it's like, and the reason history repeats is because the incentives are the same. And, you know, humans never learn that, you know, it's not the ideology that matters. Ideology is just rational. It's just the way people rationalize their incentives that they're attracted to. And so when you're arguing with people's ideas, it's like, that doesn't matter. What you need to fix is the underlying incentives. And humans never seem to learn that lesson. And So if the incentives, you know, which change over time as institutions change, as people, as new players change, as technology changes and climate changes, you know, and all the incentives change with them. And because we live in a dynamic price system where all of these things tell you, you know, the economy of everything is, you know, constantly reordering itself with, you know, new and higher and lower prices. So, and that changes things. And, you know, humans don't learn this lesson that, you know, hey, when, you know, when the left goes way too far, it's going to bring the right back and they're going to overreach. And when you have like a right wingers that overreach, like what we did in the 90s, kind of with the, you know, some of the Christian right trying to get people canceled and acting like, you know, fascists, it's like, well, I mean, that brought the left, you know, that, that brought the far left. And this is what we've had for the last like 15-ish years was the, you know, the left got in charge and they dragged everything really far to the left. And, you know, hey, they overreached and now we're about to over, you know, the right's about to take power again and overreach back. And I think the rights with the rights overreach is going to be far bigger because, again, they just handed him the excuse that he needed. You know, if there was, you know, he might not, whoever it was, might not have gotten away with it if Trump had been treated fairly. If he hadn't been gypped out of the election and cheated the way he was, you know, this, you know, this may not have happened. Whatever's going to happen may not have.
Not only did they kind of fuck him over on the election, they also tried to just completely destroy his legacy. I mean, they wanted to make sure that he goes down in the history books as traitor, loser, you know, a scar on a beautiful Democratic face, you know. And I really think that, I don't think that they read the room when they did that.
Nope.
You know how much pro-Trump stuff I still see everywhere? Like,
oh yeah.
I mean, these people, like, you know, you go through rural America, you don't see Biden-Harris signs. You don't see them anywhere. And I don't think the progressives read the room.
No, I think they think the entire country is like L.A. or New York City. They don't understand.
They did not read the room.
The flyover
echo chambers are a motherfucker, yeah.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Oh, yeah. They, like, the, I think they they greatly miscalculated. That I mean, again, this is the lesson of history humans don't learn is that incentives matter. And, you know, now you just created an opening for a right-wing demagogue to come back and take everything from you. And, you know, Trump wasn't the guy and that they were, that they should have been afraid of. Now they just created the guy they should be afraid of. And yeah. It's a real bitch. And see, there's this funny thing I talk about every now and then of, you know, George Soros's law of reflexivity, which basically says it explains the reason why we create the thing we fear, because if you know something that you fear comes up to you, you're willing to pay it or anyone to make it go away. So I mean, this is the you know, the chaos demands order to be extracted. So I mean, if you see fear as chaos and you want or you want to regain the order, you'll pay anyone anything to make it come back. Yeah, and so. Therefore, you know, because of you're willing to pay someone for something, functionally, you're willing to pay the you know someone to make you feel scared and threatened. And therefore, you bring the thing that you fear into existence because you're willing to pay someone to do it to you. And like even like a mugger on the street, because you were afraid for your own life and you don't want anyone to take it from you, you're willing to cut, you know, to pay someone who comes up and threatens to take it from you. And it's a perverse incentive. And this is one of several perverse incentives libertarians have not wanted to talk about. And I'm trying to force the issue now that, okay, this thing exists, you know, and calling it evil doesn't help. And, you know, it's true. Calling it evil is true, but it doesn't help, you know, and we need to actually address the incentive that's at work here.
It's wasted energy.
Yeah. Because if you understand that people are incentivized to have this, you know, state in existence or whatever, because they're getting rewarded for it, so, you know, in some way that makes sense to them, all of their, you know, whether they're progressive or a conservative or an independent or a moderate or whatever, or even a minarchist libertarian, you know, whatever rationalization that they've come up with is, you know, it doesn't matter. It's secondary. That like, that's not the real thing. It's a distraction from the real thing. The real thing is the incentive, you know, focus on the incentive, ignore the ideology.
So what do you like, to me, this is a really curious thing that I think humans sort of subconsciously understand all of these ideas that we're talking about with power and creating like your own worst enemy. Mm-hmm. And I know I was exposed to this idea by Jordan Peterson, Carl Jung's work with archetypes and everything. And we tell ourselves these stories. If you watch like the Star Wars prequels or Lord of the Rings, like we understand the dynamics of power and how it grows. But then when it comes to applying these ideas to real life, like people are just completely blind. Like they don't understand what's happening right in front of them.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, there's some sort of disconnect that there where they can't, they, it's really, okay. I think there's something that to be said that truth is stranger than fiction. And there might be a disconnect there for that reason that when, you know, when it's fiction or like the Star Wars prequels, it makes sense. And you can see the logical progression because it's all in 2 hours just like that. But when, but where I think, rubber hits the road and where that disconnect happens is that in reality, these things are spread out way further over time. Like in a Star Wars prequel, they're like 2 hours long or 6 hours if you watch them, if you binge watch all of them. And so when you can see it all lining up in 6 hours, you get it pretty quick. But when there's this delay factor in there, like, you know, something like this takes, you know, maybe 100 years or decades or even multiple days at a time, you know, even down to just multiple days at a time, people are very, it's very hard for them to see cause and very delayed effect. You know, that's something that a lot of people really, really struggle with. And it's like they know it exists, that there are, you know, causes with delayed consequences. But, you know, I mean, they always, like, even like with smoking, they know it's going to come back on them, but they do it anyway. You know, or like, you know, binge drinking, they know they're going to get cirrhosis of the liver or like a fatty liver. They know that's going to be damaging to them eventually. It's like, you know, it'll happen eventually.
That's later.
That's a later problem. And
people describe revolutions the same way. They're like, I went to work on Monday, everything was fine. And by Friday, the whole city was on fire. But a lot of people, I think, they get caught up in life or whatever, and they don't realize what happened to lead to that point, you know? And I think with 24-hour news cycle we have now, how do you know what's going on? Like,
no,
I mean, you could watch the news every day and still be like, what? Cause it's information overload. And that might be by design.
Is by design. I'm sure of it.
Yeah. With Overton, the Overton window keeps shifting too. It's like, I was talking to my cousin today and he has some friends that live in the suburbs of Chicago and they're way more kind of just like, go with the flow. This will be fine. It'll pass. And they're talking about some of their restaurants that are making them show proof of vaccine to get in. And he's like, well, it's not that big of a deal. You just like show him the card. Like, it's not that big deal if he's got to do that. He's like, dude, I was telling you this shit 6 months ago and you would have called me a conspiracy theorist, but now you're just saying like, it's not a big deal. Did you see what's happening? You just keep going with the flow. And it's, I mean, you see how these things happen. You stand back and you go, oh, I get it. I get it. Like, we're not a different species. Like, this is why it happens the same time every way.
Yeah. I mean, people are, you know, they're specialized for their one thing and they understand their one thing pretty well. And that one thing basically comes at the cost of every other thing. And so when you get that about people, like they have their one thing that they're good at. This is all that they're designed for, and they should be doing that because that's how they make money. This is how they survive and, you know, feed their families and all that, and, you know, provide a standard of living for themselves. And so they're you know, well informed, they're well advised to, you know, hyper focus on their one thing, and this makes them not very good at other, you know, other things, like, you know, which are very complex, like politics. It's a very, very complex thing. And so if you're focused on your thing, I don't know, maybe you're a plumber or something like that, you know, I mean, you really have to focus your energy on that. If you're spending your time on politics instead of honing your craft, you know, you're going to be missing out on, you know, a standard of living you could be having for yourself and your family, and that's not good. And so I mean, you know, when they have, and then you have add information overload from the media on top of it, on top of the fact that they're omitting quite a few other facts. And, you know, then you add in the effects of echo chambers and, you know, and you add one thing after another. It's like, no wonder people suck at voting. You know,
you can't possibly be You can't know every candidate. Like, even like local candidates, if you go to vote on a local election, like, does anyone know where you can find information on all those people? You're just like, oh, that person looks, they look nice. They look cool. Yep. We'll vote for them. And I'd like have a beer with them.
Like you said about like, the plumber, you know? Oh, sorry, Nick.
Go ahead, Mike. I won't cut you off. Never
mind. Well, you say with the plumber, like paying attention to politics, it's like if you try to do both, you're going to be a half-assed plumber and know half shit about politics. Like, you have to be obsessed with one or the other to be really good at it, too. But everyone's vote counts equally. So the uninformed mean just as much to the system as the people who know what they're voting on.
Well, it's like the central, it's like the central planning problem with socialism, right? Like no organizer planner can decide where to allocate all the resources to come up with the best outcome. It's almost the exact same thing with power in politics, like especially with democracy. How are 300 million people going to wisely choose like where power should be placed? It's impossible. Like it's the same sort of dilemma. Like that's that idea just kind of like, when we're talking about this, kind of came to the surface for me.
That's why, you know, this is why someone like, you know, mentions Moldbug, Curtis Jarvin, he says, you know, we need to be privatizing the state because that's something that, you know, people, you know, I always say people really suck at voting for obvious reasons, but they're pretty decent at when it comes to shopping. Mm-hmm. It's like they know how to shop for themselves. And because there's a price right there, it tells them the information they need to know. And then there's some, you know, on the box on the back, they have like, I don't know, maybe they're buying food. There's some nutritional information that they would need to know with some ingredients lists. And, you know, they can pick and choose based on their own values and their own needs, what works for them. And so if you privatize, you know, the statecraft, then, you know, people can begin to better pick and choose for themselves based on the information that's given to them. Because like, if you look at like what a ballot looks like, it's a name with a letter next to the name. That's what it is. That's not a price. It doesn't tell you how much their tax plan is going to cost. You know, imagine if we put that information right next to, you know, their name, what that would be. You know, it's like the libertarians win every time because they're the cheapest one. And, you know, it's like that's like one law that you could just do and it would just change everything because now you put a price on the information, you know, because like a name and a letter are, you know, virtually useless information, but like, you know, they might be have an R next to the name. That doesn't mean they could be good. They could be like a fucking neocon, or they could be a squishy moderate, and you have no way of knowing. And, you know, but if you just say, okay, here's the tax plan they support or something like that, and it's a price, and people know what to do with a number. They're pretty good at that. And, you know, but if you could just find some way to start backdooring a price system into our electoral system, you would see quite, you know, a revolution overnight towards the right, towards liberty, and because people you're giving people useful information that they have now, and right now we don't have anything like that, and this is what I think this is the way forward, is to try, you know, because you can't take a state away from people. They want it. They're incentivized to want it, and you know, just okay, let's at least make it private. And let's put a price on it so people will know, you know, what's valuable and what's not.
And you don't even have to make it. DeSantis is going to be the first one to do it.
I think so.
He's going to be the king of Florida.
Dude, if he wears a crown, in public, I'll move to Florida.
Yeah, I would do it. I would move back to Florida.
Yeah, I actually, it's funny you mentioned that. We have a family friend who moved to Florida from Illinois after spending his whole life here, over 50 years. And he just went down there and he loves it. He's been apolitical. I think he used to vote Democrat, but now he's just like all amped. He's like, he says he's gonna get an American truck and he didn't even know what to call it. He said the yellow snake flag to put in the airside of his truck. He goes, I'm a Florida scumbag now. You gotta have that if you're down here with a pickup truck.
Pretty much.
I'm just like, whoa, what happened? I love it.
So. I was born and raised in Central Florida for 23-ish years. And so like, when I see all of a sudden, my state that used to just be ridiculed for having all the crazy people and really just crazy Northerners coming down, and you know, then the media calls them Florida Man. But you know, now all
a bunch of people from Wisconsin,
like everyone else got, you know, every other state was the crazy state, and ours was the normal one because we stayed just the normal level of crazy. And well, I'm so proud.
It's like that Waylon Jennings song. I've always been crazy, but it's kept me from going insane. You know, it's beautiful. So. One thing I wanted to touch on in this episode. So your namesake, Popular Liberty, makes me think of making libertarianism a populist idea and why that's important. And I think that right now that is very important, because the time for libertarian purity, pure anarcho-capitalism ideals, as Pete Canonas would say, living in Encapistan in your head, this is a really tone-deaf time to be living in that world. And right now we had, like, look at the last 10 years. We had Ron Paul, Bernie Sanders, and Donald Trump. Like, all of these kind of counterculture, anti-establishment movements gathering. And that energy is just building steam, and it's not going anywhere. And what I would like to see is libertarians sort of injecting our ideas into that energy and kind of commandeering and steering it. And I know Tho Bishop has talked about this. Tho Bishop, I heard him talk about on Not a Podcast, he talked about like talking even to Q people. You know, it's like, you know, he goes, yeah, you know, they're anti-Fed. He's like, just tell them, like, oh yeah, you know, that banking cabal, you know what they're doing is keeping interest rates too low. Like, start educating people, sort of like subverting them. So what do you think that sort of like populist energy that we're seeing, what would you like to do with that?
My name actually has like 5 or 6 different meanings. It's one of those, it's 2 little words, but they can take them quite a few different ways. Populist liberty is one of them. And with that new populist energy, I think, you know, actually Nick Fuentes said it this morning on his Telegram that he says, I'm not a populist, I'm a reactionary. I think that's what just happened. I think all of that populist energy just turned reactionary. And, you know, I think that's where it is. It's going to be, again, there's this energy that we're seeing, because initially it started off in 2008. This was the beginning of the populist movement. Ron Paul was the first populist. And because he was running on the popular issues at that time, you know, which we had just come off of the Fed, had printed a shit ton of money. We'd given bailouts to big banks, you know, and that was been stolen from the people, adding to our debt that our children are going to have to repay.
A five-year-old war.
Yeah. And it's like, we had these wars that were just, it seemed like they weren't ending, and they had lied to the American people about, you know, war that killed millions of people. And it's like they had put the war on the credit card, you know, so to speak. And, you know, it's all out of control. And there was rightfully a populist backlash to all of this. And it just happened to really coincide with everything Ron Paul was saying. He wasn't popular because he was a libertarian. He was popular because he was a populist. And it was just a freak of nature coincidence that the populist issues of that day were the issues that libertarians have been best on. And as those issues kind of faded from memory, well, they, you know, so did the libertarian revolution, the Ron Paul revolution that, you know, we had. And what happened was they got transferred all over to that populist energy got transferred to Donald Trump, because there were new issues and he was really excellent on those. And unlike Ron Paul, Trump managed to consolidate power in a way Ron Paul didn't, because, I mean, he's a libertarian. He doesn't have that killer instinct.
He's too nice.
Yeah, yes. I mean, he's a nice guy. He didn't cheat hard enough. He should have cheated better. And
he should have said some mean tweets.
Yeah, by the way, Trump should have cheated better too. But but that both of them didn't. And I think whoever's going to come along next, he's going to learn from Ron Paul and he's going to learn from Trump. And, you know, I think, you know, this new populist energy, it's gone reactionary now. And this is the way cycle of history always repeats. And because now what they've incentivized is a hardcore right-wing reactionary to come along and, you know, bring the system to the ground, burn it down, because this thing is evil. This thing, look what it did to us. Obviously, this thing is a threat. It's got to go. And
do you think that political violence is going to become the norm in the next few years?
From the left, yes. From the right, no.
Man, the right is so soft.
The problem with the right is not that they're soft; it's that their leaders are soft. The right has all of the guns, and they were all of them. They were ready to use the guns last year, and they are ready to start shooting their elected representatives and shooting at their government. They were ready to do it, but they didn't have any leaders. Because remember, the right is hierarchical. They need a leader to give the order, and none of the leaders are willing to give that kind of order. And so the right, they're not soft, but they're orderly and they're hierarchical. And that's what actually holds, paradoxically holds them back from using political violence. And unless you somehow get a real change in who the, if this Augustus comes along and he's willing to use political violence, you better bet the right's going to do it. It's like they're ready to do it. And this is something I'm very concerned about, because I'm not a fan of using violence to get our way. It can work, but it usually doesn't. And it just has very mixed results, and it's a high risk strategy. So if if we do get a new leader who's willing to give the people the permission, the wink and the nod they need to, or even just the explicit, okay, it's time to start shooting our leaders, then you're going to see the right really just massacre the American electorate, elected officials. You'll see them get massacred.
You know what Curtis Yarvin said? That was another one of those moments where it's like, oh yeah, duh. Is when he talked about the difference between force and violence, and how libertarians like really didn't understand the distinction there. And it's like, yeah, violence is bad. Like, just bloodshed and chaos is not beneficial for anybody. Force, on the other hand, is kind of a neutral thing. It's like, it can be good or bad. It's like, you don't need to start splitting heads because people know that you can do it, so they comply with you. And like, if we look ahead to if we get our crystal ball out and look at like the next 5 to 8 years with like the coming elections, I don't know what to expect. Like, I really, my gut feeling like got me to this point. And then it's like, okay, where do we go from here? And I have no idea. We could see somebody like Ron DeSantis, like just have this huge moment and take over, and then things kind of splinter off. California secedes. I mean, who knows what could happen there, but when you head to 2024, What do you think is going to happen? What do you think is going to happen?
I can tell you, I can't tell you what's going to happen. I can tell you what's incentivized. And you know, what is incentivized is a right winger to come along and, you know, declare the system unfit, you know, for purpose, and, you know, burn and run on burning it to the ground. You know, the current crop of right wingers, you know, whoever wants to be president, you know, whichever of them decides to run on, I'm going to go to war with the bureaucracy, you know, they're the enemy, and the corporate press is the enemy of the people. And, you know, they want you dead, but they'll settle for your submission. They're the American enemies, and I'm here to go to war with them and burn the system to the ground. It's like, it's not time to conserve. The Constitution has not been conserved, and there's no going back to it at this point. So we're going to need a new one, and that's something that's going to need to be far stricter than what we had before, something like that. And, you know, he can rattle off, oh, it'll be anti-abortion, it'll have term limits, it'll have, you know, this, that, and the third. And, you know, at that point, you know, it's like he has to run on burning the system to the ground. That's what's being incentivized right now. Whoever does that will get the power. And possibly a bullet to the head too, but you know, they might get JFK'd or MLK'd, you know. But you know, it's like, this is, you know, this is what's being incentivized in 2024, and we'll see if any of them respond to that incentive, because if they do it, they'll get the power.
I see a few of them gearing up towards it.
Mm-hmm. And I look at, like, you know, Tucker Carlson, because, you know, he actually name dropped, you know, Curtis Yarvin. It's like, oh, I love Curtis Yarvin. He like, in a world where he's a bad guy, you've gone way off the rails. And I'm thinking, like, a DeSantis Tucker ticket would just be.
Well, I know that Phil Bishop has said that too. I saw him tweet that the other day.
It's like, I would prefer a DeSantis Tucker over DeSantis Rand. And
well, yeah,
you know, like, when it comes to the liberty movement, it's like, guys, aren't you tired of losing? Don't you want to be on a winning team for once? And it's like, okay, like at the Ancapistan crowd we don't stand a chance at actually winning anything. But you know who does? Are a lot of disaffected Trump voters and a lot of disaffected Fox News viewers who are sick of watching their conservatism just fail and fail and fail. And I think, like, when you were talking about, like, Florida Man and how all of those crazy Floridians became, like, the most sane people in the country, it's like, those are our people, the people with the, or at least I can speak for myself, like, you know, people in pickup trucks flying Gadsden flags. It's like, I have way more kinship with them than I do with people in New York City for the most part. And I would like to be on their team and actually, you know, get my policies through and start forming those kind of communities.
Are y'all going to become Florida Men?
It's on the short list.
Yeah. I mean, I'm kind of tied here for personal reasons for a decade, but I'm going to try to get out of here as soon as I can. If it holds up that long.
I'm not married to any area at the moment. So I could be a Florida man within a couple of years.
Oh, I would certainly be looking hard into it right now.
I will not miss Illinois winters at all.
Like, I keep seeing what's going on there. And, you know, my dad lives down there and I'm just like, man, they just keep winning.
Yeah, at everything.
And like, how can you even question like the results? I mean, they opened up early. They stayed open. They're not going to lock down. They're actually going against all that. And now they're, you know, people are moving there in droves.
Oh, so not like, only that, DeSantis has had one policy win after another, you know, outside of the lockdowns. Like, I don't know if you guys have heard this, but, you know, he managed to, pass a, you know, school vouchers for like private schools for all kids, any kid, you know, regardless of income, can get a private school voucher, you know, and get out of the public indoctrination system now. And on top of that, he's going to war with the public, with the teacher unions too, to, you know, really drive even more nails into it. So if you got, I don't know if you guys have kids yet, but that's something I look at hard, you know, they don't even have that here in Texas yet.
It's and
yeah. And like, I look at something like that and say, gosh, you know, if I had kids, I would be looking hard at, you know, sending them to a good Christian school rather than, you know, that, you know, on taxpayer dimes, you know, and he's had one like gun reform after another that was good. I forget what it was, but I think he just made it Florida constitutional carry state. I'm pretty sure that's what it was. I might be wrong about that, but I'm pretty sure that's what it was. And I mean, he's just winning all over the place. And it's like, why wouldn't you? And he's building credibility as a right-wing reactionary. That's what's being incentivized. And he's responding to the incentive. And he clearly understands that, oh, what you need to be saying, these people are the enemy. And he's calling them the enemy by name. And I mean, it's a wonderful thing to see. And I think, again, he's responding to the incentives. People just behave in their incentives. Ideology does not matter. It's the incentives that do.
Did you notice how he totally took the spotlight from Kristi Noem too?
Yeah.
She, you know, because she didn't ever lock down or, form any mask mandates. And for a while they were talking about her. And then the minute Florida opened up, it just like Ron DeSantis just totally stole the spotlight.
Well, he led the charge. Like he would do it. And then Abbott would like follow slowly after he'd see how people reacted first. And you tell he didn't have the balls to be the first to do it. And Kristi Noem did great, but you know her state—it's a lot, you know, a lot smaller than Florida.
It's smaller. For that primary, I can tell you right now, he's going to pay for that. You know, for being second every single time to DeSantis, he's going to this primary is not going to go well for him.
I was going to say, I think if DeSantis runs in 2024, he wins in a landslide the nomination. I mean, I think it's going to be a bigger, you know, route than Trump had in 2016. Like that's the way I see it. I think he will like by far be the most popular.
Listening to you talk about it being in Florida and us in Illinois, it's literally like we've been in two different countries this whole time. I mean, you're talking about your governor's fighting for you and all this stuff with the schools and the kids. And like, we're trying to fight our governor to stop torturing our kids with muzzles. Like, well, I got four kids, one in school, three, not quite. I live in a 3,000 person town and we basically had him go mask optional. 200 counties in Illinois went mask optional because the parents have had enough. Our school board was about to do it, but then our governor just mandated that all schools K-12 got to do the masks, even private schools. And we're pushing back. I mean,
so tough. I feel so sorry for your children.
You know? I spoke at the school meeting last week and unloaded on the school board and told them you're torturing them. This is child abuse, and you know you're not representing your constituents. We're gonna go. We're gonna move to recall you if you go forward and follow the governor over your constituents. Is it or you can? Your other option is you can fight back, be a hero, and you'll never pay for a drink in this town ever again. Or option three, just go forward and say you're doing it and don't enforce it. They'll keep the heat off of you, and our kids are left alone. So we'll see what happens. But we're organizing protests. We're sending our kids mask-free the first day with the parents. We're all going there. We have do not comply t-shirts made up. So there's a huge resistance. We got
can you
like,
make like a miniature guillotine?
Yeah, we have like 200 counties all pooling together right now. We're, I mean, we have like a Facebook page and we're all communicating with leaders. So it's getting a lot of traction.
He also had the, that you mentioned Facebook. He also has that social media bill where he's cracking down on big tech for censoring people. Right. And he passed it. It signed into law. And the now they're suing it in court.
Yeah, they took him to court, yeah.
But, you know, I think he could win it. And there are some real easy fixes he could do if they strike it down. They probably will. But if they do strike it down, there's some real easy fixes he could do. Just put a tax on every act of censorship and you'll bankrupt the bastards. And by the way, the power of taxation is virtually unlimited. So if you want to say, hey, we're raising revenue and we're going to cut a property tax, to boot, because Florida doesn't have an income tax. And so you have to cut a property tax with it. And you could raise taxes on big tech, on the enemies for their behavior of censorship, which people hate, and, cut property taxes at the same time, kill three birds with one stone.
Yeah. Did you also see he's looking into taking pay from school administrators that their school districts enforce mask mandates on kids? Mm-hmm. He's looking to withhold their pay.
Oh yeah. And he even went a step further, when you had these, liberal counties in Florida decided that they wanted to, really enforce all of these, punitive fines on businesses that tried to stay open during the lockdowns that they had. He said, you need to get, he signed an executive order, say, give them every dime back. And he made them give the money back. The government gave money back to the people that they had taken on, wrongfully. And I mean, you just see that this is the incentive of the moment. And history's literally about to repeat itself again. And that's what it looks like. And short of a bullet to the head, that's about the only thing that's going to stop it from repeating itself. And I just don't think that's going to fly. I think if they were to put a bullet in the head of Ron DeSantis, I really think people would, break their need for leaders and just start shooting the government, because that's what they've gotten. That's the point they've driven these people to.
I agree. And
if they did, I can tell you right now, the incentive for another politician to say they put a bullet in DeSantis's head, let's put a bullet in theirs. Yeah. And it's like, again, they're creating their own enemies by their own fear, and it'd be better if they just stopped fighting.
I think you're right about that. I think, and especially when it comes to DeSantis, God, I lost my train of thought just now. Oh, that's the worst. Oh, no, we're talking about DeSantis. Okay, no, somebody else take it. It'll come back to me, I promise.
I was talking about how they were incentivizing. If they put a bullet in DeSantis's head, they're going to be they just create an incentive for some other right-wing demagogue to come along and say, well, okay, we need to – they martyred Trump and they betrayed him. They cheated him out of office. And then when we tried to put DeSantis in, they put a bullet in his head. And, they're creating all these incentives for themselves.
So are you of the belief – I know there's kind of two camps. There are people that want DeSantis to run for president, and there's a lot of purist libertarians that are saying, like, yeah, well, he's a Zionist. It's like, okay, compared to, what, every other president of our lifetime? Like, that's like going to be the same no matter
Americans
what.
Who are, like, pro-Israel,
Yeah, exactly. It's like – so do you want to – like, okay, we could actually stop the COVID policies from being a thing, but we're going to – keep sending aid to Israel, or we could have somebody who is all for all of the COVID policies
and sends aid to Israel.
What is the point of like, oh, this is the hill I die on. I won't support
it like this. It's like if they could end all of the COVID policies and double the aid to Israel, I would, my finger would press that button so fast it would get a blister.
Same. Hard same.
You know what I mean? It's like, I'm sorry. You know, I'm sure there are good people over there that are, you know, getting destroyed and it's really sad, but you know, I don't really control that. You know, and I don't support that. And, you know, but I want what's good for my people and I have to prioritize them first because that's what's valuable. That's the incentive. I'm incentivized to prioritize my own people, you know, over, you know, some god-awful shithole in the Middle East where, you know, the only correct foreign policy for the Middle East was what God had in the Bible where he just flooded it.
And, you know, it's like, how are you going to control a tyrant on the other side of the world when you can't even control your own tyrant at home? It's bloody impossible.
That's my Jordan Peterson. But yeah, no. So are you of the belief that, it really is. So are you of the belief that somebody like DeSantis should run for president, or you think he's better suited as being like a mini president in Florida where he has way more absolute power? And do you want to see an America where we have 30 DeSantises that are all consolidating power in their own states rather than trying to change things on a national level?
It depends. If DeSantis runs the way he's incentivized to run, then yeah, I want him there because I want someone to campaign on burning the system to the ground. Because I think that, again, that's the incentive. If he chooses to go balls out and behave his incentives the way he's been doing so far, then, you know, I think that he absolutely should, because that's the best good he can do. If he's not going to campaign on burning the system to the ground, then he's probably better off as the governor of Florida. But he's term limited in Florida. So if he gets reelected in this 2022, he won't be able to run again in 2026. So he's term limited. So by that, he's already incentivized to reach for the next higher thing in 2024.
Cause it's like, what does he do if he runs out of his terms of governor, then what is he going to go to the House of Representatives where he has no power to actually push his policies? I mean,
House of Representatives and he was just a kind of nobody there. And, then he came down back from Washington. He ran as a decent candidate. He was better than the other guy. Than Adam Putnam was the other.
Was that the drug addict?
No, that was Andrew Gillum. In the Republican primary, he was running against a agriculture guy or something like that named Adam Putnam. He was just like the biggest putz. You know, he was just a nobody. He was a real moderate, not kind of an anti-Trumper. And, you know, just this guy would have been awful. And
like an Adam Kinzinger type.
Yeah, he was an Adam Kinzinger type.
And that's my guy, unfortunately.
Oh, I feel so bad for you, buddy. But I'm sure you'll correct that in this next year.
It'll actually motivate me to vote. Yes, it will.
It's brutal.
But, Andrew, so we are coming up on time here. So we're definitely going to have to do a part two of this and kind of flesh out some more ideas of archotropism in practice and reality. So until then, where can people find you? Plug your YouTube channel, your socials, anything else?
Well, you can join me on at Mises GOP on Twitter and in the and we have a MeWe group set up, and we'll be having hopefully a donation link soon for that. We don't have that yet, but it's coming, I promise. And if you want to check out my content, you can find me at Popular Liberty on Twitter, and you can find me at Popular Liberty on YouTube, and you can find all of my stuff there. Please like and subscribe. I'd like to get to a thousand on YouTube soon. And I'm the main moderator in the Part of the Problem Inner Circle, so you can always catch me there.
Hell yeah. Right. Speaking of which, I still don't got that MeWe thing to work out, man. We'll figure it out some other day.
Yeah, if you figure it out or just create a new account, I can add you immediately. I'm pretty good. You don't have to wait 2 or 3 weeks anymore to get into the inner circle. So within hours, I usually approve people. So
I have sort of let my just this past couple weeks, I let my Gas Digital subscription. I didn't update my payment method after my card expired. So hopefully Andrew doesn't throw me out, but
nope.
You know, I'll keep going there. You know,
with Robbie and Dave, the way they always ran it was they never checked to see who was a current subscriber. It's just, if you paid once you were in, and I run it the same way like a robot. So
yeah.
Awesome.
So I got 5 years under my belt.
I deleted my Facebook like 2 years ago, but the only thing I missed was the Inner Circle, and then it got abolished anyways. So I was like, I'm never having Facebook again. That was the only thing worth having there. But well, cool, Andrew. Thanks for joining us. Nice to finally meet you. And yeah, all listeners, you guys should check out his stuff. Great content. And please go to iTunes and rate, review our show, and follow us on Twitter at Paul's to the Walls with a Z.
Oh, and at Kimura King 69, Kimura King 69. It's not sexual.
Thank you. Paul, it's been a pleasure.
All right.
Take care.
Without the ones like you who work tirelessly to keep things running, everything would suddenly stop. Hospitals, factories, schools, and power plants, they all depend on you. No matter the weather, emergency, or time of day, you're the ones who get it done. At Grainger, we're here for you with professional-grade industrial supplies. Count on real-time product availability and fast delivery. Call, clickgrainger.com, or just stop by. Grainger, for the ones who get it done.
When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.